Danger. The emergency destruct system is now activated.
Cake and grief counseling will be available at the conclusion of the test.
She's alive! Alive!
Maybe you should put some shorts on or something if you want to keep fighting evil today.
Why not just put a stake through her heart?
She's not a vampire.
Oh, you'd be surprised how many things that'll kill.
We are now seeing the beginnings of another stage of human evolution. At last, we can retire and give up this life of crime.
You and your training wheels.
Hailing frequencies are open.
Hello, sweetie.
Commencing countdown. T minus 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to the Skiffy and Fanny Show.
The best little sewing circle in Washington Territory with Elizabeth Bear.
I'm Sean.
I'm Paul.
I'm Julia.
And our special guest, obviously, is Elizabeth Bear. Hello, Elizabeth.
Hi there.
So for those that have no idea who you are, of which there are only 8 people left, and they all listen to this show, could you tell us a little bit about yourself and your work?
Well, I am a clinically diagnosed science fiction and fantasy writer. it's not contagious. What do I tell you about myself? I wasn't prepared.
You like roosters, we found out.
Well, I don't know if I like roosters. I don't like roosters. For those of you who are just tuning in now, this being the beginning of the show, we were discussing before the show a critical Googling error I made when I was young and foolish, which involved looking for purposes of a story, looking for a place to buy a black rooster on the island of Manhattan. Make sure Safe Search is on, because you can imagine what I, being relentlessly clean-minded, typed into Google. we had digressed into a discussion of roosters before the show started.
And now when the show has started.
It's not my fault. I left the roosters behind.
Well, I can't leave well enough alone.
How about
roosters on the cutting room floor, but no.
How about we just leave it at Elizabeth Bear is a multiple award-winning science fiction and fantasy writer who also podcasts and does other things, including make unfortunate Google searches occasionally.
I think that should be your new bio.
There you go. Yes, unfortunate Google searcher. I do need a new bio. I'm tired of the current bio.
So the book we're here to talk about today came out from Tor, I believe, at the end of January or early February.
February 3rd.
And it's a book called Karen Memory.
Yes.
So tell us a little bit about that book. Just kind of give us a rough idea for folks who have not read it yet and should probably read it immediately.
Okay. Well, the elevator pitch for Karen Memory is heroic prostitutes versus disaster capitalists in a made-up steampunk gold rush city. And if that doesn't sound awesome, it's not the right book for you. a book that grew out of several visits I made to Seattle, Vancouver, and San Francisco over the course of about 10 years, and just sort of being in love with that particular aspect of the Wild West that during the westward expansion of, you know, European Americans, the West Coast rapidly became kind of an outpost of civilization, in part because of the trade from Asia, and also because of the gold rush in Alaska. And part of what's going on here is that because it's a steampunk history, and we get to hack technology and hack history a little bit, I've fast-forwarded kind of so that stuff is going on in the 1870s in this case that didn't happen until much later in our world. So it's a steampunk world which has slightly more advanced technology, which also means that there is more immigration across the Pacific. It means that there's a different, slightly different blend of ethnicities in the Pacific Northwest than there was in our world. It also means that it's much easier for people to get around from place to place. Railroads are happening faster. Airships exist. Steam-powered ships exist as a method of transportation. All of this is background to the novel. It's not actually, like, really discussed in terms of what's going on with the characters. It just sort of affected my world building.
I actually did want to talk to you a bit about the world building. So sure. You started with the world building first. My original question is, where did you actually start? Because there's so many elements intersecting in this novel. I was curious where you actually began. So you began with the conception of the West Coast in a steampunk environment?
Well, not really. I'm a incredibly nonlinear person. And if you can't tell from talking to me, the initial concept of the novel was I was approached by an editor to write a YA steampunk novel with a lesbian protagonist. And I said, well, I have this idea with heroic prostitutes. And she said, that sounds great. And then I wrote her a proposal and she wound up passing on it. I sent it to my editor at Tor, and her comment was, is there any reason why this needs to be YA? And I said, the person who originally asked for the proposal wanted a YA? And she said, we can sell this as an adult novel. Don't worry about it. I think it's still pretty YA friendly, actually, with the exception of, you know, contains language. There are a couple of really creative swearers in this book. It's all sort of a gestalt. You have the characters, you have the setting, you start thinking about the interplay of the characters in the setting, you start thinking about slightly more advanced technology, like what Jules Verne /H.G. Wells level technology would have on the American West Coast in, say, the 1870s. Like, what would be different? What would be happening faster? What would some of the changes be? And then you just kind of, it iterates. It's like a rose. You know, you start like at the center and then every petal sort of builds until it gets bigger and bigger and bigger and mm-hmm. makes this sort of spiraling thing. Am I making any sense at all?
You're making absolute sense to me. But no, because I found it interesting that that Rapid City, which is kind of like your alternate Seattle, kind of, sort of.
Yeah.
Although you have other influences. You have San Francisco and Anchorage influences in there, although there's an Anchorage in the novel itself. It seemed very westward facing. I mean, Bass Reeves, who I'm sure we'll talk about a lot in this conversation, is from further east. But for the most part, this whole novel and the characters all seem to be westward facing. And the East Coast could go hang, really, for most intents and purposes. So I was curious,
have you ever been to coastal California?
I lived in Orange County for 8 months. You remember?
Yeah. So you are then familiar with the concept of East of the Five.
Yes. That's true. Yes. Exactly.
Basically, yeah. I don't think I did it consciously, but my experience I lived in Las Vegas, so I spent a fair amount of time on the West Coast. And my experience of West Coast cities is that literally nothing east of the Five exists. It's just it's like the entire world is this 15-mile wide strip of the West Coast. And I think I just sort of imported that into my characters without really thinking about it. Like, it's just sort of their base assumption. Even the people who come from somewhere else, like Karen, who I picture is coming from someplace, in the north central plain states. I didn't really make it specific where she's from, but somewhere in the area of western Minnesota, the eastern Dakotas, northern Nebraska, you know, that general area.
That's where I got the impression that she was northern plains, like North Dakota-ish, or Fargo, for crying out loud, or something.
Yeah, you know. So, you know, it just sort of, for them, everything interesting does come from the East or go to the East. You know, people go to Alaska to make their fortune. These are people who have come as, go to the West. These are people who have come as far West as they can possibly get. You know, and their further opportunity lies to the West, except for the people who have come here to the West Coast of North America from further west, you know, so far west that what we think of it as the East. And that's when it all sort of breaks down, is you've got these people who have come there from China and from India to make their fortunes, and then discovered that it's a little trickier than they were led to believe. Because I'm not giving away too many secrets to anybody who knows anything about the 19th century gold rush towns, to say that there's a huge aspect of human trafficking going on in this novel, and it's a major plot thread.
Absolutely. So, Julia, you wanted to jump in here.
Yeah. So, I just wanted to talk about a little bit about the character of Karen and her voice in particular, because it's very much a very distinctive, striking voice, and. You said you started this with the idea, the prompt of writing a YA steampunk novel, but I kind of wanted to know a little bit more about where that voice came from. Did it just kind of spontaneously arise and overtake you, or was it something you carefully worked at?
I think I poked at it a lot. Just in hearing, you know, because the first line of the novel, and in fact Karen's name, comes from something that a friend of mine, who is Karen Memory Bruce, who the character is named after, that she said to me when I was discussing this book with her early stages. And I said, yeah, I'm trying to write this proposal and yada, yada, yada. And she said something that was a direct quote that turned into the opening line of the novel after I just sort of like worked it over and worked it over and worked it over until it sounded right. And then once it sounded right, I realized I had the character's voice, and then I knew like where she was from and what her backstory was and how she had, I suspect that some of, if I remember correctly, I had just recently read, Molly Gloss's brilliant book, The Hearts of Horses, which is amazing. And I highly recommend it to everybody. Oh my God, what a good book. Which is about a young woman who has the life that Karen kind of aspires to get back to. She's a traveling horse breaker, and I think that one's set during the Great Depression. It's set later. I'm pretty sure that there was a little bit of an homage to Molly's book in there. I think. Trying to remember, you know, this was like 2009, so.
Well, that's fair. It just seems like she's such a capable voice, and she's leading us through the story very, like, she grabs hold and then doesn't let go. I found the book very hard to put down because I was just like, okay, what's she going to say next? Because I'm here. I'm with her. But the other thing that struck me about it was that you mentioned that there's a different kind of mix of people, but I noticed that there was a big mix of people, and you have everything from Native Americans to ex-slaves to immigrants from India and China and all over the place. So Paul mentioned Bass Reeves, which is a great sort of person that is a real historical person. What kind of went into that mix that you created, and how did you decide to make it different from what would have actually been there at the time?
Well, you know, an enormous historical boyfriend crush on Bass Reeves. history boyfriend, dibs. I'm sure his wife would not take kindly to that. But there's this thing that happens where the way someplace is presented in fiction becomes the way people perceive it as having actually existed. And one of the things I really liked about a number of the recent Weird Westerns I've read is that they've been making an attempt to show the West as much more what it was really like, as the more diverse community, diverse and yet segregated community that it actually was. I'm thinking of like Emma Bull's Territory here and, Karen Joy Fowler's Sarah Canary. And you see these stories that actually engage with the fact that there were a lot of people, in situations in the American West who do not fit into the cowboys versus Indians paradigm. And the historical figures who we just don't care about anymore, people like Bass Reeves, people like Quanah Parker, there's a lot of really interesting stuff there that kind of gets dropped out. And I think that it's a better story if you include the complications. And include there's so much fun to be had there and so many interesting people to talk about that I want to put them in the story and try to do them justice.
This actually goes to one of the questions that I had, and it kind of bounces off something you'd said much earlier, in which you had talked about how the technological aspects are very sort of withdrawn. And that's one of the things, like, when I started reading it, I thought, oh, this is going to be a steampunk tale, and it's going to have lots of, a terrible example would be, like, Wild Wild West, like, it'd be like a giant spider machine or something. But what I got was actually this very different kind of story, a story about the political complications of, well, A, because we're dealing with characters who are prostitutes, but additionally because of some of the things that Julia has raised here, which is that you're dealing with all of the diversity and the very problematic political history that is existing at this time. I mean, everything from – I think you have one line somewhere. It's just a throwaway line, and I realize what you were doing, where you mentioned that two characters could not get married because of their race. And I don't remember what the laws were like exactly, but I know at one point it was illegal for certain people, like China – people from China could not marry, an American white male or something of that nature, or wouldn't be recognized. I may be saying the history a little bit wrong, but the point is that I think what's really interesting is that you bring in so many of these sort of minor details that kind of lay out this foundation, this complicated foundation. And so I don't know if it's quite a question so much as a curiosity in your method for sort of bringing all of these minor details together to sort of paint this really complicated, nuanced canvas.
Well, I was just trying to paint an accurate, or at least a quasi-accurate, because obviously this is an alternate steampunk universe, picture of the time through the eyes of somebody who has grown up in that culture and who takes it for granted. I mean, this is a young woman of 16 who has never in her entire life considered for a moment that someday she might be able to vote.
Yeah.
And there's a thing. I mean, assuming Karen lives that long, it's, and I'm terrible at mental math, and assuming that the timeline follows what it follows in our world, but she'll be in her late 60s before she's actually able to cast a vote.
National. And,
national.
I think Washington had it sooner.
I believe Washington did. And one of the interesting things about President Rutherford B. Hayes, who is president in the book, he never shows up. He's off screen. But one of the interesting things about him was that when he was in Ohio, I can't remember exactly what local government elected office he was holding, but he actually attempted – this was before the Civil War, by the way – actually attempted to pass legislation such that black citizens in Ohio could vote.
And that probably didn't cope well.
You know, I mean, there's a lot of this when you start looking into the history, it's a lot more complicated than we think it was. You know, and so these are people who almost all of them are disenfranchised, literally disenfranchised, and yet they're still trying to find some way to exert a little bit of power and agency and control over their lives. Which is, I think that we as writers often miss. We assume that somebody who's oppressed has no agency, and of course that's completely fallacious. Everybody has agency. They may not be able to exercise it, but that doesn't mean they don't have desires.
That's a fair point. Julie, I think you're probably going to bounce to the question I was thinking of, so I'll let you jump.
I'm probably not, honestly. So if you have a question that you think really goes with this topic, go ahead and ask it now.
Talking about agency, I think the really interesting thing that – I mean, this is a book that is about prostitutes, which I think in a large respect, we don't think about people who are engaged in the sex trade in its various incarnations as having agency, at least not historically. And yet this is a novel that clearly – everyone involved has some degree, I mean, with the exception of those under Bantles. They have agency, but we don't really see them in that respect. They're far more oppressed in that respect. But having this novel be about prostitution in such a direct way, it seems like it's a really interesting way of exploring that question to me. Was that an intent? It was sort of when you sort of set it up in this way, were you thinking of that as you were exploring their lives in Madame's house?
Well, I think once you start talking about prostitution and historical prostitution or present-day prostitution, you can't avoid that question unless you're going to resort to either stereotype or, you can either do the best little whorehouse in Texas thing, or you can do the sex workers are universally oppressed and downtrodden thing. And those are sort of the defaults. You know, you got the hooker with the heart of gold, or you have the damsel in need of rescue, you know, the soiled dove in need of rescue. And it seems to me that having known a few people in their time who engaged in sex work for whatever reason, they weren't different people while they were doing that. They were still the same people I had always known. You know, if I met them while they were doing the sex work, they did not become different people when they stopped. It's not, you know, it's a job, for crying out loud. And yes, sometimes it's a really shitty job with a horribly abusive boss that that involves incredibly abusive relationships and exploitation. I've had straight jobs like that, not to the same degree, not to the degree where, you know, because there was no legal support for me, my boss could literally break my jaw and get away with it. But certainly I've had emotionally abusive jobs, for crying out loud. And I just thought of it on that level. You know, it's Karen thinks of her job as a job. It's a job, and it's, in her case, a pretty good job. But she's aware that there are other people doing the same job who are not treated well. And she considers herself very lucky to be in a position where she is working for someone who is a good boss, but who's still, you know, I think Madame Damnable is very much an authority figure. And she's not always on Karen's side. So I thought of it as an employee relationship.
Yeah, I think that would be – it's a very fair way of thinking about that because, of course, she has her own set of rules. This is how the house has to run. And if you don't follow those rules, well, bad – you know, something bad's going to happen. In the same way, right? Like if you show up late to work, you know, bad stuff's going to happen. Sorry. Yeah.
Okay, so that now that that's out of the way, because I thought it was just great that there was a a house full of women who were doing their jobs, and they kind of had camaraderie in that. And that was not necessarily the worst thing in the world or the best thing in the world. It was just kind of their working life. I really enjoyed that. And I enjoyed the fact that Karen just kind of would occasionally talk about it as work and just be like, yeah, I hump with men, but that's just my job. What I wanted to talk about is I feel this conversation has been ridiculously serious. And I understand that we've been talking about the fact that there are all these people of color, there are all these other marginalized, disenfranchised people. And we've been talking about like having agency when you're living under terms that are oppressive, which is all well and good. But I think that we might be giving the impression that this book is actually like not fun, when in fact it is just basically at its heart an enormous amount of kind of dime store novel, pulpy adventure action fun.
Oh, heck yeah.
I was waiting for that to come up, Julia.
So I kind of want to dig into some of that. Like, what are some of your favorite things that maybe influenced this? What were some of your favorite things that you came up with? Because you have all kinds of really like neat things in the book. Just what was the joyfulness of this?
I did so much cackling while I was writing this book. The bit with the hat pin. you know that I'm not going to spoil it, but you know the hairpin rather. And I just, there's just the dialogue surrounding that moment and Karen's description of that moment. I had one of those, I can't believe my fingers are typing this, I have the greatest job on earth moments, while I was writing that bit. I loved the banter. I loved the fact that I had a book full of witty people who weren't afraid to have opinions, and have them at great length and, you know, with appropriate hand gestures. I had too much fun writing The Obnoxious Cat. The Obnoxious Cat is actually based on a real cat. Many of my fictional cats are Tuckerized from life. And the senor is based on a cat that belonged to my mom's partner that I cat sat for 2 years while my mom's partner was stationed in Korea. And he was just like that, except he had no actual name because he was deaf and couldn't come when you called him. So he was just the big giddy. And he was horrible. He was so horrible. But it just the horribly delightful. You know, he bullied all the other animals and would stand outside my bedroom door starting at 5 o'clock in the morning and start screaming to be fed. And what his cries were completely unmodulated because he couldn't hear himself. He was stone deaf and always had been. So he mewed like a 25-pound kitten crying for its mother. And I just So Karen's mixed emotions about that cat are so, and trying to give this, and he, like 6 months after I started taking care of him, he decided to go into extreme kidney failure and try to die on me, right? And I'm like, oh my God. I came home and found him passed out on the bathroom mat, literally comatose because he was in renal failure. And then after that, he had to get pills and he had to get subcutaneous fluids. And this cat was Attila the Hun. I mean, it took two people wearing work gloves. You had to wrap the cat in a towel, literally sit on him. And well, the other person gave him the fluids. So anyway, so I greatly enjoyed writing that particular cat into the narrative and making him Karen's problem. the language, the colorful Western slang. There are entire websites devoted to colorful Western slang. I had to limit myself. I had to set severe limits on myself as to how much of it I would use because I was in danger of becoming incomprehensible. as this stuff is just as playful and completely opaque as like rhyming Cockney slang or thieves' cant. It was a really fun book to write, and a lot of that is Karen, and just the fact that she's one of those characters who has an opinion, likes to hear herself talk. I will always prefer to write a character who likes to hear themselves talk. And so few of my characters do. I keep writing these recalcitrant, close-mouthed, have to pry every word out of them types. So she was a great relief. Also, she gets herself into trouble because she never saw problems she didn't think she could solve by running at it fast enough. So, so she's fabulous. You know, she basically, you just put a quarter in her and she goes.
Which is probably a good thing, because this would be a very short novel
if
you weren't willing to talk. One of the things that Julia had mentioned, one of the really fun parts, is you actually include little snippets of basically what would be like Western pulpy writing. I believe you include snippets from, I don't know if it's real, but one involving Marshall Bass Reeves at one point. And I believe there's a Calamity Jane, which I swear is real. I don't know if that's real, but it sounds like it would be real. There are all of these really fun pulpy stories that are you know, basically happen at like story time. They talk about all of these adventures. And it seemed like it was really interesting because this, in some way, that's kind of where the narrative of the story starts to go with some of that adventure. And it was, so talk about incorporating some of that in there. I mean, did you go and read actual, like, the period relevant pulp novels, dime novels?
I did read some dime novels, or at least portions of dime novels, and they you can find them online if you wish to go find them. The both of the ones that are quoted in the book are my own work, but the Calamity Jane one is a quote true unquote story about Calamity Jane that was written up in several dime novels of the era. I just redid it in my own words in the style of the times. The other thing that's fabulous is 19th century Western newspaper accounts. They are brilliant. They are so much fun to read. Because I've also written a book that features John Henry Doc Holliday as a major supporting character. I've done a whole bunch of reading up on him, including some of the primary sources. And some of the newspaper articles and like dime novel style pulp retellings of his adventures. You know, there's the actual real life Doc Holliday probably never shot more than two men, and one of those was an accident. And he shot the guy's toe off because he was drunk and aiming at somebody else. You know, there are just so many great colorful characters. There's the Earps and the Mastersons and these whole sprawling families of just ne'er-do-wells wound about west because they were persona non gratas out east.
Paul, I think you had a question you wanted to jump to.
I first I wanted to make a comment going back a little bit about Karen. I did give you almost a tagline that she's not the protagonist you expect, but she's the protagonist that you want.
Yes.
I stand by that. I found it interesting that she's uneducated, but she's intelligent. And as you pointed out before, she runs at problems rather than runs away from problems like a sensible person. And
like any sensible person would.
She just goes head on into them.
Yep. We all have a friend like that, right?
Yes, we do.
And the secret is those people make great protagonists because you don't have to work. They're like the Scooby Gang, you know. They see a problem and they're like, let's go solve that mystery. And you're like, yeah, that was easy. They're the best characters to write, you know, the Franny Fishers of the world. I guess when I was writing the book, I didn't realize how unexpected the character was. It didn't feel like a radical character to me.
But it is subversive. I mean, as Sean said, it's a steampunk action adventure. And okay, your main character is a prostitute in a in a quote-unquote sewing circle who's intelligent, opinionated, not educated, but willing to learn and just runs at things. That's not, I mean, you have all these little details of other stuff that you could have had as your protagonist. You talk about scientists battling each other.
I love that detail.
Like, yeah, it's like, wait a minute. I can imagine a bunch of writers writing the novel from their point of view, and that would be the standard approach. But no, you go for the completely unstandard approach. It's like, wait a minute, what about the scientists? Okay, I'll stick with Karen. But wait, what about those scientists? What are they doing?
Well, I'm thinking about, like, I don't know, like Sherry Priest's stuff.
Bone Shaker and that.
Yeah, where she writes an awful lot of working class protagonists. I mean, her protagonist in Bone Shaker is a woman who works in a factory, who's a single mom.
Yeah.
I think it's, I don't know. Maybe it's just that women authors become a larger part of the genre marketplace, we're peddling our own wish fulfillment characters.
I don't know. I think for me, I really love stories like this because it's not necessarily down to the gender or anything like that. But I really like it when the story comes and finds the ordinary person.
Yeah.
And comes knocking on their door and is like, hey, by the way, you're going to be involved in a bunch of crap now.
Yeah, there's a great tradition of those sort of male working class heroes, right?
Definitely.
Certainly.
Definitely.
Yeah. I think what maybe I can make sense of kind of what Paul was getting out of the subversiveness is it goes back to something you'd said much earlier, which is, you know, we have these narratives about the West that we are told. We see them in the movies. They're somewhat romanticized. They're usually about dudes running around, like, you know, having gunfights and, you know, doing that Western stuff. But the story that we're presented here is one about characters who are not normally talked about, at least in those larger narratives. And so we're getting Karen Memory's story. But on top of that, you're doing all of this really fun stuff with, you know, this world is, to some degree, it's just insane, and in a wonderfully charming way. it really is. Like the scene that Paul's talking about, there's the one moment when she's reading the paper to tell whether or not there's going to be a mad scientist demonstration that day. Right? It's that moment where you're thinking, like, oh, we're going to see some crazy mad scientist, like, blow up a city block. But that's not what happens.
She wouldn't have gone out if that was going to happen.
True. I think what's really fascinating is that you have this world that is, you know, it's got all of these kind of weird bits. They're like new technologies or mad scientists being crazy, which is wonderful. But the story is so much rooted in Karen and her sort of experience of this world. So, you know, you could have like mad scientist demonstrations in the middle of the story, but the more interesting story is what's happening to Karen, how she's responding to this world, to the complications, and to some degree, the fun that she gets to have within all of that. I don't know if that kind of answers what Paul was kind of getting at, or if you agree with that, but that's kind of how I was viewing it.
No, that sounds very reasonable to me. I think that there's some of, like, Karen's relationship with the technology in her world is that it's, I try, this is an ongoing thing for me as a speculative fiction writer, is I try to write worlds where, whether it's science, you know, where it's super science or magic, it's integrated. And I had made the decision early on that Karen's world was going to be a world where there wasn't any magic, that it was, you know, 19th century super science only, that there wasn't, it wasn't going to be the kind of steampunk where there are sorcerers and so forth. Although there is cryptozoology in her world, because that was a cookie I gave myself. there are Sasquatches and Pacific tree octopuses and so forth and so on. So I try, and I think some of this has to do with, you know, my relationship with technology as a fairly technologically comfortable member of Gen X. Like, you know, like the modern tech is not as completely integrated into my every minute as it would be if I were 10 or 15 years younger, because I clearly remember a time before VCRs and cell phones and personal computers. And, you know, like I remember when all of those things happened, which is something that people who are 15 years younger than me don't. But I also use all of those things, you know, comfortably and on a daily basis. I just bought a new car. This is like my big grown up thing for 2015, right? The first actual new car with a car payment, car that is not already in middle school that I have ever owned in my life, which also really marks me as a member of Gen X. You know, I'm 43 years old and now I have a new car. This thing syncs with my cell phone.
Wow.
I know, right? I don't need a headpiece. I don't need a Bluetooth wireless thing to talk to people while I'm in my phone because my car does it. Like if I'm listening to the radio and I get a phone call, my car automatically clicks over to my phone and I can answer it like by saying answer or
those newfangled technologies.
We live in the future, man. I mean, forget jetpacks. My car talks to me.
Science fiction present, as I say on my blog. Yeah.
Science fiction present. So I mean, I'm comfortable with that in the way that I noticed that, like, my mom isn't necessarily. And she's pretty technologically savvy for somebody, for a baby boomer. You know, she's beaten every level on Angry Birds. She's not. She can program the VCR. She's got the whole programming the cable thing to record. I can't remember the technical term for it. To record stuff so you can watch it when you want to watch it thing down. Anything that's like immediately relevant to her life, she figures out like that. Email, she's good. But but technology isn't integrated into her life the way it is integrated into mine. And I also realize that it's not as organic for me as it is for people who are a little bit younger than I am. For them, it's just a thing that's always been there. It's part of the background radiation. Laptops are the way the world works, right?
Yeah.
And what I wanted to present in terms of Karen's world, there actually is a point here, is that she is integrated into this technology on a way that's unconscious for her. She doesn't have to point it out. She doesn't think about it. It's not new. It's not novel. She's 16 years old. There have always been mad scientist battles. You know?
Yeah. It's just a thing.
It's just a thing. If she were 26, she might have a different perspective on it. This might be new. It might be a little weird. And when she encounters, over the course of the story, a new technology she hasn't heard of before, she's like, oh, I hadn't seen that before. I guess that's a thing now.
So talk to us a little bit about the sewing machine, because
yes,
one of the things that did happen in the late 1800s is that mechanical sewing machines became a thing. And that really did change a lot about how fabrics were made into clothing and other things. But in this case, you kind of turn that up to 11. And Karen does seem to be quite at home with that.
Yeah.
Maybe you turn that up to 11D5. I'm not sure. Well, but I'd like to hear more about that.
So we're talking about the singer here.
Yes.
For those of you who haven't read the book, spoilers, there are two. So this is not a thing Terry Pratchett made up. In the American West, and specifically in the city of Seattle, prostitutes were listed on the tax rolls as, quote, seamstresses, unquote, and they had to pay a sewing machine tax, which was something like $50 in 1890 dollars. It was a ridiculous amount of money. It was, you know, just like, nobody who was actually a seamstress could make this amount of money. Because the protagonist's boss has a sense of humor, she's like, all right, if I'm going to have to pay a sewing machine tax, I'm going to have a goddamn sewing machine. And she's got this, because it's a steampunk universe, there's an industrial singer that is a sewing machine that is manufactured by Singer for basically mass producing garments or carpeting or upholstery, and it's a mech. It's a sewing mech. It's you know, you can picture Ellen Ripley in this thing, basically. And that was what I tried to like keep in mind while I was writing this, is this is the Ellen Ripley forklift of sewing machines. And because it's an adventure novel, Karen on a couple of occasions gets to use the sewing machine to fight crime. So I had two things in mind with that. One, you know, obviously I needed her to have access to some kind of awesome technology. In terms of, because it's a steampunk book, there is that expectation that at some point there's going to be awesome gadgetry, and the awesome gadgetry is going to fight other awesome gadgetry. You know, it's just kind of, it's in the genre expectation. And it wasn't a genre expectation that I really wanted to subvert, because I wanted to have an awesome technology fight. But there's also the, There's a thematic level going on there where the sewing machine is the quote unquote symbol of, you know, her life as a fallen woman. It's the seamstressing. There's also the old joke about the Ladies Terrorist Society and sewing circle that I had in mind. Do you remember that one? Nobody?
No.
I don't think so.
Oh, it was a thing in the 70s. There was a t-shirt, Ladies Sewing Circle and Terrorist Society. It's a feminist thing.
Huh.
Maybe you had to be there. Yeah. Google it. It's a really cute graphic. I may still have a vintage lapel button up in my room somewhere. But I was also thinking of like the thematic implications of, you know, well, women should look to their sewing, you know, the feminization sort of that labor, and also the sort of implied oppression of working class women who made their living by sewing. And there's a lot of there's a lot of like thematic unpacking there. Some of which is conscious and some of which is subconscious, and none of which is necessary to think about to enjoy the book. But it was all stuff that I put in there because that kind of stuff makes me happy.
I think that all of that, I mean, like, your book can be really exciting and fun and also have all of these deeper implications. I think that's part of what makes this book, for me, was really deeply enjoyable. Partly because Karen Memory, she's just so much fun to read.
Excellent.
Yeah, well, her voice is lovely. Julie had mentioned that before. I did love her voice. I love all of the sort of the Western kind of stuff, the pulpy elements to it, little bits of technology, the mad science. I just want like a newspaper article that just says mad science battle's gonna happen.
Yes.
Like it's weather. Like it's no big deal.
I love the fact that I was so smug and pleased with myself, and I realized that if the prostitutes had to pay a tax, the mad scientists would too.
Yes.
just the idea of like the mad science tax, and that's what they call it. And somebody had asked earlier what my the question I never got around to answering, what my influences were in terms of like the fun pulpy aspects of this, other than the actual pulps. And I used to play, there was a game called Castle Falkenstein, if anybody remembers it.
The RPG?
The RPG, yes. Which is very early steampunk RPG, early 1990s.
Yeah.
Played with playing cards. There was some of that in there. There was definitely a big, I had a big Joe Lansdale, Tim Truman, Jonah Hex influence. You know, which is great pulpy fun. I just actually sat down and reread them all this year, and they're still delightful. A couple of aspects that are a little problematic, but I think by and large they've aged pretty well. And there was something else that I had thought of, and my entire 80s post-apocalyptic swords and sorcery fixation, which grows up of being a child of the Thundar the Barbarian.
Yes! Yes!
Thundar!
Demon dogs!
Upla the Mock and Princess Ariel. Yes.
Portrait has no idea.
I know about
Thundar. You can find it on YouTube. I highly recommend it.
About Thundar.
Yes.
Oh, I thought he was before your time.
Well, it was before my time. That doesn't mean I didn't have the internet.
Thundar the Barbarian. It was only on for like 2 years, I found out.
Yes,
our childhood.
I think that's a lot of – I know this is off topic. There's a lot of cartoons. It's like there wasn't as many of them as we thought there were. It's like it's only 24. I'm like, wait, what? I remember dozens of them. What happened?
Yeah. No, it's – I don't know. It's some of them turned into Electric Company episodes or something. There are so many Electric Company episodes.
Well, Julie, do you want to jump in?
Sure. So first I was just want to say like how much I love the fact that Karen is actually good at sewing. So she's paying her sewing tax so that she can get on with her whoring to make her money to do her savings so she can eventually have her stable. But she's also using the sewing machine all the time, sometimes for battle, sometimes sure. In battle mode. But more often than not, like actually as a sewing machine, because she's actually good at that, which delighted me. But I wanted to talk about another.
Well, Karen's a femme, which I'm not. And that was interesting to write because I had to think like from the perspective of somebody who's really into dresses. And I'm sorry, Julia, you were about to say.
No, that's totally great. The other piece of technology that is just really very present in the story is this glove that appears pretty early on. So I'm going to go ahead and talk about it a little bit.
Sure.
That the big villain wears and he uses it to control people's minds.
Yes.
Peter which Van is like the most super villain glove ever.
Yes. It also electrocutes people.
Yeah.
So yeah. Tell us about this glove.
I just invented the scariest thing I could think of. I like what's the thing that would make me, you know, pee my pants if I had to deal with the guy who was wearing it. And I'm like, how about a glove that electrocutes people and mind controls them? That's you know, I wanted something that was like visually really striking. And there are a lot of science fiction and steampunk stories that have like mind control rays and, you know, death rays and so forth and so on. But the idea of him being this very grasping, venal kind of guy, it just seemed natural to me that his evil superpowers would manifest in the forms of a glove. Does that make any sense?
Oh, yeah, that makes total sense. Bantle.
Sure. And there's that whole Darth Vader thing too, you know, like the mind control gestures. So.
Yeah,
mind control works better when you make choking gestures.
As I was reading it, I was wondering, because you mentioned before about there being no sorcery or magic in the book, and a lot of steampunk does. So I was wondering as I was reading this for the first time, I was like, okay, is this magic or is it science? And well, it does turn out to be science. Spoilers.
Science.
Well, but okay. it's science in the sense of like one of the traditions from Mage the Gathering is science.
It's mesmerism, which is a totally legit 19th century science. Totally legit. It has something to do with phlogiston. Or ether or something. Totally legit.
the glove is a very terrifying instrument. And I think when you were telling me that it seems like that's the thing that Bantle would use, it's like, yeah, that's exactly what he used. But I think one of the interesting things about this villain is, you know, he's – at no point is he a likable person. And I hope that was your intention.
Yeah.
Yeah. I hope that – yeah, because the second he shows up on the screen, I was like, yeah, I don't like him. You can go away now. But I think what was interesting is that, you know, obviously he's doing all of these questionable legal – activities, well, in most cases, maybe not technically legal, but because they involve certain groups, disenfranchised groups, they maybe are legal. But I like that that one of the methods that he uses for gaining power is he actually tries to go through the legal system in order to get elected. He registers as a well, at this time, Democrats were maybe not the likable party by our today's standards.
The Democrats were not the good guys in 1870.
So I found that really interesting that you sort of, in some sense, foregrounded, but inserted this element of having an election season and having that kind of political element to sort of heighten his villainy to some degree, because it's not enough for him to just be the guy with the scary mind control glove. He's now also got to be like mayor of the town.
Sure. Well, you know, not to spoil, but he has some big plans that mostly involve him making a lot of money at the expense of other people. You know, it's the disaster capitalism thing. Yeah. I really just asked myself, what would somebody in this situation who had absolutely no morals and a strong profit motive, what would they do? Who would they be in bed with? What kind of decisions they would make? In early drafts of the book, there was actually an additional secondary villain who got taken out as Clutter, who was another guy in largely the same position that Bantle is in, but a little more powerful. And I just decided to get rid of him.
Just to streamline it.
Yep. I unpersoned him.
Because people may not be familiar with the term disaster capitalism. It's come up a couple of times as we're talking about Bantle, without maybe revealing anything about his plans, because they need to read the book or else.
Sure.
But maybe talk a little bit about, what disaster capitalism is, I guess it would be, so that people can kind of understand what we're talking about.
All right. Let me. I'm actually going to Google up a definition here. I don't have to screw it up by trying to explain it. Because this is the future. Oh, look at this. Dictionary.com. Okay. Disaster capitalism. The practice by a government, regime, etc. of taking advantage of a major disaster to adopt liberal economic policies that the population would be less likely to accept under normal circumstances. Now, by liberal economic policies, they do not mean socialized education and good roads. what they basically mean is a relaxation of corporate controls. Right. And the bad guys in this particular novel are actually attempting to create these circumstances. They're attempting to engineer the circumstances that will cause that to happen and thereby increase their profit. I think everybody in this book is probably a capitalist of one stripe or another. You know, Karen's entire motivating force at the beginning of the book is to amass capital so that she can go forth and purchase the property, become a property owner, and therefore set herself up in business doing the things she really wants to be doing. That's why she's working at the whorehouse. But I feel like she's making her money in an ethical fashion. She's providing a service for pay.
Not trying to destroy things.
She is not actively destroying anyone else's person or livelihood in order to earn her own. I feel like that's sort of the difference between her and Bantle.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. That's the core difference. Something we haven't talked about actually with Karen, which I'm surprised we haven't brought this up. She mentions throughout the book her father, who has – I'm not going to reveal anything, but her father's passed away.
Yes.
And that has a lot to do with one of her conflicts in the novel, is that the thing that she wants to do, what she wants to get her money for, she's to some degree afraid of it.
Yes.
Because I don't want to reveal but basically talking, could you talk a little bit about the conflict without maybe trying to spoil it?
Talk about the conflict without talking about the conflict.
That's
no
really,
sweat.
I don't think I can do that, can I?
No, I can swing that. Basically what's going on with Karen is that, and part of the reason why she's wound up where she is doing this job that pays very well, but is maybe not what she wants to be doing for the rest of her life. She is very good at another trade, which she learned from her dad. But it's not a trade that is generally associated with women. And also her father's death has left her with ambivalent feelings toward his career. How's that?
Yeah, I think that, that gets at that the heart of that conflict, yeah.
And I think there's a thing going on there that, that Karen's not really aware of, which is that part of the reason that she's not doing that, that she's not just going out and doing that thing that she's very good at and would probably enjoy doing more, even if she wasn't making as much money, is that if she does that, she has to own up to the fact, like really on a deep level, that her dad's not there to do it with her anymore.
Right.
You know, and I don't think she's ready to do that at the beginning of the book. I think she's got, she and her father had a very close relationship and she admired him greatly. And yeah, I mean, I think possibly she may see him a little through rose-colored glasses, but you know, hey, she's the narrator; she can do that. I have to believe her. I'm not sure that anybody in the real world could actually be as awesome a parent as her dad appears to be in hindsight. But you know, maybe he was. Maybe she got real lucky in the parent lottery, and I feel like there's a conflict within herself that she has to work out before she's willing to go try and do this thing that she both wants to do and is afraid to do.
Yeah. Yeah. And I do think it comes to maybe there's a little bit of that rose colored glasses kind of thing going on. But I think on some other level too, that the relationship she has with her father is one of, you know, now that her father's gone, she kind of realizes the value of the things that he taught her.
Yeah.
Because his advice comes up many times throughout the book. She'll get into a situation or see other people in a situation and she'll remember what her father said.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that there's some aspect of that that maybe happens to all of us when our, or I'm assuming I've not had a parent pass, but, that when people we love pass, we remember things about them that maybe we took for granted.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's something that she's also kind of working through, kind of understanding not just what she learned from him in terms of the trade, but learned from him as a person.
Yeah. No, I think you're absolutely correct.
Paul, you want to jump in on this?
I actually want to switch to a slightly different subject. We mentioned him briefly before, but I wanted you to talk about Bass Reeves and how and why you decided to bring him into the book. I mean, I had vaguely heard about him, and I must have came across some sort of reference to him before he shows up in the book. So I was just curious as to why, how you came to choose him and insert him, and how the difference between the fictionalized version you have here versus the real life Bass Reeves.
Oh yeah, Bass Reeves, my history boyfriend.
Yes,
I actually have no idea where I learned about him or how I first heard about him. The internets, no doubt, because the internets are full of cool things like that. Bass Reeves, for those of you who do not know, those of you playing our home game, was a black man who was a U.S. Marshal in the Indian Territory, what is now Oklahoma, during the time period in question. This was an area known to be incredibly lawless and dangerous. He did a job that almost nobody else would do. And this is a man who was illiterate, was an ex-slave, knew the Indian Territory because he had run away from a master in Texas and hid out there, basically, with the people who lived there, some of whom were, you know, many of whom were native, some of whom were native tribes like the Cherokee that kept black slaves. Some of the Cherokee, this was one of the places where the Cherokee were relocated when they were relocated. If the history as we have can be believed, this is a man, Marshall Reeves, who not single-handedly, because he always had posse men with him, but who brought in more than 3,000 wanted criminals over the course of his career, which is a record that I don't believe has been equaled by any other U.S. Marshal to this day. he always got his man. And there is actually a fairly significant body of thought that he is probably the person who was the model for the Lone Ranger. Mm-hmm. Because one of the things that there's a bit in the book where Reeves gives our protagonist and another character a silver dollar. And this is apparently a thing he did on a regular basis, was handed out silver dollars to people who helped him, which was one of the ways that he kept people on his side, as he was very magnanimous. A dollar was a fair amount of money in those days, you know, in the days of penny a pound candy and so forth. So I find this guy fascinating. I find his accomplishments kind of incredible. And he did, you know, live into the 20th century. He lived to a ripe old age and fathered a ridiculous number of children. I don't even remember how many it was. A nice big family, even by 19th century standards. There are several photos. He was a very tall, broad-shouldered, handsome man with a really spectacular mustache. And so I did actually manage to work a couple of Lone Ranger jokes into the text. Bass Reeves was one of his horses was a chestnut mare, a very large chestnut mare. And it so happens that before he started riding Silver, the Lone Ranger's horse was a chestnut mare named Dusty. So,
oh,
yeah. So that's where that comes from. You know, I got the silver dollar thing in there, and so anyway, it was just my little homage to a historical figure for whom I have the utmost respect and admiration.
And you do work in that mustache.
I do. That's a heck of a mustache. Even by the standards of the day, it's a spectacular mustache.
I feel like you'd have to have a really good mustache back then.
Yeah.
If you could grow a mustache, you should have a good mustache. Otherwise, there's no point.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. All that oil, just give that little curl at the end, you know?
Absolutely. Get the little mustache wax in there.
Yeah.
They hadn't invented surfboards yet, so you had to do something with your wax.
See? Exactly. Yeah. If I lived back then, I would have, like, the coolest. That would be my thing. I'd have the coolest mustache. And then I'd grow a beard and, like, put curly bits in my beard.
There you go. Sideburns. Mutton chops.
I don't know if I could do mutton chops. I think maybe I could pull that off. Maybe.
God.
Yeah. we're running a little bit over an hour, so I think this would be a good time when we kind of start to roll out. So Karen Memory's out, which means people got to go buy it or else. So that's out. But what can we expect from you, say, I mean, if you've got any short fiction you want to maybe mention that's coming out, or if you are working on another novel that may be coming out at some point in a future.
I just sold a short story to fantasy and science fiction. It's called The Bone War, and it takes place in my Eternal Sky universe.
Yay!
It features everybody's favorite character, Bijou. Yay! and a bunch of paleontologists.
Sweet, yeah. Yeah.
And it is part of apparently the current cycle of stories I'm working on, which appears to be the academic satire cycle. I'm not sure what's going on with that, but I've just written like three in a row. And I've been vastly entertained by them all. So that'll be coming out. Charlie Finlay told me sooner rather than later in fantasy and science fiction.
Okay.
Sarah Monette and I just delivered the long delayed third and final novel in the Ice Crine series, An Apprentice to Elves, which will be out in October. Cool. It is delivered. It is all over but the screaming and the page proofs. They're sending us a check. It's only 5 years overdue, so we're both pretty thrilled about that. I am now working on a book I'm working on two books simultaneously. I'm working on a book called The Stone in the Skull, which will be the first in a new Eternal Sky trilogy, set in a different part of the world with different characters. It's a road trip buddy flick between a couple of unlikely mercenaries. Fafford and the Grey Mouser, if Fafford were an enormous metal robot and the Grey Mouser were a sort of disenfranchised sacred knight.
You can't see my jaw dropping here, Bear, but my jaw is dropping.
Sorry. This is the Gage and the Dead Man that showed up in the story of the Ghostmakers. Their further adventures.
Okay.
Excellent.
I am also working on a book called Ancestral Knight, which is that's knight with an N, not knight with a K, which is a big idea space opera, replete with, salvage operation, galactic politics, novel systems of government, and rampant Ian Banks homages.
Damn.
Oh, man.
As I said before, I don't think there's a subgenre of fantasy and science fiction you can't write. You seem to be colonizing them all.
Yes. So right now it's steampunk, epic fantasy, and space opera. So.
And next I'm expecting Talking Cats.
Talking Cats. You know, that's a possibility. Actually, I've written a story with a talking cat.
Okay. Done that.
Yeah.
All right. Well, so perfect. So, everybody should go check out Karen Memory, and keep an eye out for, fantasy and science fiction with your new story. And obviously books that are probably not going to drop till next year, I'm guessing, because we're going to have to wait like a torturous process. That is, why must we wait?
They're not written yet.
Well, there's that too. That's a problem. but thanks so much, Elizabeth, for joining us.
Me.
Absolutely.
Party.
And it was kind of a party, right?
Yeah.
Excellent. And thank you, Julia.
Like a real party and not a, you know, Black Widow party.
thanks, Julia, for being my co-host.
Yep. It was great fun.
Yep. And thanks, Paul, for...
Like I was going to miss this.
I know. I told Elizabeth in an email. She checked today whether or not the time was, you know, still happening. I was like, yes, because if I rescheduled, Paul would kill me.
Well, Paul got the book ahead of everybody.
He did.
I think
he made us all jealous.
Well, I guess on that note, that'll be my awkward ending time. So awkward
ending
and scene. If you would like to send us hate mail on this episode or any other topics we've covered, you can do so in a number of ways. You can send us an email.
SkiffyandFanty@gmail.com.
You can send us a tweet.
@SkiffyandFanty.
Leave a comment on the blog.
SkiffyandFanty.com.
Go to Google+.
Shawnee Jen.
And or Facebook.
The Skiffy and Fanty Show. Our intro music comes from Time Flux by Revolution Void. You can check them out at freemusicarchive.org.
Another weak human afraid to face death.
I fart in your general direction.
France, different planet.
The Force will be with you. Always.
This is Ripley, last survivor of the Nostromo. Signing off.